Thank you, David. Thank you all for coming. Yeah, so I'm going to tell, just how it came about that I found myself in this unlikely position of writing a biography of Dr. Gell-Mann. No, I thought the first. Yeah, Dr. Murray Gell-Mann. Now we will call Murray, because no one who knows him can resist calling him Murray, I don't think. But I was thinking back of when I first heard of this man, and back when I was in college in the 1970s and was being pulled in two directions, wanting to be a scientist sometimes and wanting to be a writer the other time, and kind of slowly converging on this idea of writing about science. And back then I was just devouring all the popularizations like Lincoln Kaplan's little biography of Einstein that's so good, and I've mentioned before George Gamow's books, 1, 2, 3, To Infinity, and another book he wrote called something like 30 Years, it shook physics, or anyway, it's about 1930 and the quantum revolution, and a great book by Barbara Lovett Klein called, I might be confusing the Gamow and the Klein titles, but they're both just these excellent, exciting stories about the making of quantum mechanics. And then I was trying to read things too, like that nice, nicely thin, kind of reddish book, Space-Time Physics. And understanding these things enough, qualitatively to, satisfy myself, which later led to writing about them. And this is when I first, I'm sure, saw the name Murray Gell-Mann, this rather interesting, exotic-looking surname, and I had no idea, where he might have hailed from or what the story might be. And about that time, I was working in my first job at the Albuquerque Journal covering the police beat. And this was a job where you worked from like 3 in the afternoon till about 11 at night. And once on my day off, my best friend Richard Friedman, who was a fellow physics junkie and kind of, unfocused person at the time, told me that, oh, you won't believe this, there's this guy named Murray Gell-Mann, and he's going to be giving a talk up at Los Alamos. And, this is the quark guy, eightfold way, quarks and all this. And it just seemed, very exciting. And I, he called me at like kind of 11 o'clock in the morning or something. I was probably still asleep because I'd worked so late the night before. And I thought, oh, no, I'm sorry, I just can't do this. And so I missed the chance to, get a great preface to what would turn out to be my biography of Murray Gell-Mann some 2 decades later. The first time I actually saw Murray was in Santa Fe, and I had come out there in 1992. I took a year off from the Times to write a book, and while I was living out there, I was hanging out at the Santa Fe Institute, and I first started seeing him. My first memory of specifically seeing him in person was at a place called Soli Sambra, which is an estate outside of Santa Fe that used to belong to Georgia O'Keeffe in her later years and now belongs to Paul Allen. But for a brief interlude, there were occasionally conferences there about complexity theory put on by the Santa Fe Institute. And in this one, I believe, would have been the summer of 92. I was out there, and it was the first time I saw Murray Gell-Mann, and looking more like the lower right hand, or actually the lower right column of pictures. He was giving a talk, I can't remember about what, but somehow chaos came up, and then he kind of lit into this tirade against James Gleick, my colleague who had written Chaos, of course, and then more recently a biography of Richard Feynman. And Murray was just, putting down especially Chaos as being, contributing to the public misunderstanding of science. And it was just so intense that I was a little taken aback, because I had very much admired both of these books, and in fact had just sent Jim a letter saying that I was just blown away by his Feynman biography, and this had reinforced this desire I'd had for quite some time to write a biography of a scientist and try to capture the person as well as some of the science for a general audience. And I thought of and discarded some other possibilities, like John von Neumann, who, though several books have been written about von Neumann, I still don't think there's a really, really good biography of him. And you hear stories about von Neumann driving drunk on the curvy highways around Princeton so he could do experiments on the effect of ethanol on his mandibular balance system or something. But the more I heard stories about Murray, I realized he was at least as interesting as von Neumann, and there he was. So I was too shy to introduce myself to him, but one day at this conference in Santa Fe at Solisombra, I sat down for lunch and, you know, brought my sandwich to the table, and then suddenly somebody sits down across from me and I look up and it's Murray, and he introduces himself. And I introduce myself as George Johnson with the New York Times, and he says, "Oh, the New York Times," and kind of smiles. "That's that place that employs this Wilford person." And I thought, well, John Noble Wilford, yes, you know, the Dean of American Science Writers, really nice guy, my colleague. And then he launches into a story about Wilford calling him up sometime within the last decade when a story had appeared in Physical Review about, you know, some experiment that was interpreted as finding a fifth force of nature or some kind of adjustment to general relativity. I can't remember the details. And he had called Murray to get a quote on this, just, you know, a great physics name, as you do in journalism, to, you know, kind of evaluate this objectively. And as Murray told the story, he told Wilford, "Well, yeah, you know, it's an interesting paper, but, you know, no one's ever heard of these guys. There's not very likely to be a fifth force of nature. It's going to have to, you know, that's such a huge burden for anyone to claim to have crossed that, you know, you shouldn't, this is probably not newsworthy. It's something other physicists will look at and will go, fifth force, huh? And then there'll be other experiments to try to replicate this. Most likely a year from now, it'll, you know, be gone." But, you know, Wilford had been asked to write a story about the discovery of the fifth force of nature, and he had, you know, written a very responsible account of it. And he keeps trying to push Murray, "Well, okay, but, you know, we are going to run this story, and, you know, it would really help to have a quote from you to put it into context." And then Murray keeps resisting, and then Wilford keeps pushing him, as good journalists will do. And I could just imagine John sitting at his computer terminal writing this thing on deadline, and it's coming up, and you have Murray on the end of the phone, and, you know, quibbling over all the details of this paper. And then finally says, "Well, look, Dr. Gell-Mann, if this does turn out to be right, would you say that this would be an important discovery?" Something we've all done, you know, you're trying to feed someone finally a quote because you need to get it. And he said, "Well, yeah, I mean, of course, if it turns out that there's a fifth force of gravity and you have to, you know, completely rewrite physics and general relativity, yes, that would be a very big story." So the next day in the paper, again, as Murray tells it, the story appears on fifth force of, you know, scientists claim to have found fifth force or new force. And then Dr. Murray Gell-Mann of the California Institute of Technology said, and then, so he was just really, really quite dumbfounded and taken aback. And it was one of his favorite stories. And from there, it just got worse. He said, "Well, you know, science writers, it's a nasty, nasty business of science writing. You know, they get things wrong, and they're just the mistakes." And then he said, "But I must admit, it used to be worse." He said, "There was a science writer, a man of such impenetrable stupidity that he refused to believe in the neutrino." And this turned out to be another New York Times science writer who had gotten two Pulitzer Prizes, one of which was for breaking the Manhattan Project story after Hiroshima. And it just went on and on from there. And I had heard from talking to various of Murray's friends at the Santa Fe Institute that he himself was in the midst of writing a popular book and that he was having a great deal of difficulty with it. So I looked at him and said, "Oh, Murray, I hear you're, you know, writing, you know, book of your own. How's that going?" And he just kind of said, "Oh, well, not very well." And then he turned to the person next to him, Seth Lloyd, I think it was, and started talking about superstring theory. So that was my first encounter with Gell-Mann, and I felt like, you know, I left him thinking I was just, you know, complete nothing, and felt rather, you know, that I'd been curtly dismissed. And a few months later, I was at a Halloween party at Seth Lloyd's house, where he was renting in Santa Fe, and Murray came in, and we were all carving pumpkins, and Murray sat down next to me, and he said, "Well, you know, this book writing, turns out to be a little harder than, you know, I expected. And I thought this was really a nice kind of conciliatory gesture. And then we kind of, you know, for a while anyway, kind of bonded and really liked each other and got along. Time passes. I went back to New York, and during the time I was there, I decided I really did want to write a biography of Murray. So I wrote up a proposal, gave it to my publisher, who I'd already done several books with the same editor at Knopf, and I really wanted to do it for them. So he thought, yeah, this would be great. So we, you know, worked out an arrangement, and you know, the way these things work, you sign a contract and they agree on an advance against royalties. They pay you a big chunk of it right at the beginning, which was enough for me to leave the New York Times and move to Santa Fe and start writing this. So after I'd written the proposal and gotten the check, I decided I should probably tell Murray that I was planning to do this, and because I knew he wasn't going to be, you know, terribly receptive to the idea of a biography of him. As you probably know, there are two kinds of biographies. There's the authorized biography, where the author has an arrangement with his subject. And in a case like that, usually the subject of the biography has veto power over it, and but also basically agrees to give you a certain amount of access, like, you know, complete run of their personal files and all of their papers, and in return they have approval and veto power over the book. This is not something I wanted to do with anyone, and I think it would be particularly difficult to do with Murray. So I didn't want to do that, but so I was really nervous. Like, well, I got to tell him, you know, I'm going to do this, because I, you know, ideally I'll be able to interview him. So I sent him a letter, you know, the old-fashioned way on paper. This was just not pre-email, but it wasn't ubiquitous. And I didn't hear anything. Of course, Murray never answers letters. A little later, though, just out of the blue, with no warning, I pick up the phone in my office at the Times, and it's Murray, you know, nice as can be, saying, oh, I got your letter, I'm so sorry, I haven't answered it, and I think it's just wonderful that you want to write this biography of me, and I think you're a fine science writer, I know it would be good, but I'm sorry, I don't think I can cooperate with you at all. And so, and I said, well, why is that? He said, well, you know, this, now at this point he was writing The Quark and the Jaguar. It was far from coming out. And he said, well, I talked to my agent, and this is John Brockman, who many of you know or know of. And he told me that, you know, he thinks that I should, you know, the next thing I should do after The Quark and the Jaguar is to write a biography, an autobiography or memoirs. And he says, you know, this could really be big. An autobiography of Murray Gell-Mann, but if in the meantime he's beat to the punch with an unauthorized biography, that, you know, this could, you know, really cut into his sales. Then John Brockman actually called up an editor. I don't know why this particular editor in England, you know, someone who likely would buy the British rights to the memoir of Dr. Murray Gell-Mann, and just ask him, said, well, can you just tell me off the top of your head how much you think something like this would be worth in the British market? And he named a figure, and he said, well, now, let's just suppose that, you know, a journalist wrote a book that came out first and before Murray's, what would it be worth then? And he named a considerably lower figure, and then Brockman brings this information back to Murray and says, well, you know, you can decide whether you want to cooperate with George or not. And, you know, Murray thought, well, this is going to cost me serious money, so I'm not going to cooperate. So I thought, well, you know, that's too bad, but most biographies are written of people who are not alive, so, you know, it'd be nice if he wanted to cooperate, but I decided the only thing to do is just to start working. I started interviewing people, and eventually I interviewed about 100 people that knew him through various stages of his life. And I started with the oldest people who, you know, might not be around or their memories would be fading. I think the first person I interviewed was Abraham Pice in his office at Rockefeller, and, you know, just a wonderful man in my experience. And I learned that Murray called him the evil dwarf, one of the many Murray appellations I was to learn. And I thought about having an appendix in the book. You know, Yang and Lee are those two Chinamen from New York. and Pice was the evil dwarf, Madame Wu, of course, the dragon lady, and you know, he had a nasty name for almost everyone he really admired, it seems like, and much worse names for people he didn't admire, like Pice. So I interviewed Pice and then Victor Weisskopf, who Murray had, you know, was his first real mentor when Murray went to Yale, and just started collecting these things, tape recording most of them, and then going out to Caltech, where I spent a couple of weeks during two visits. First, just interviewing everyone I could find there in the physics department, and the first thing that happened when I got there was Helen Tuck, you know, the secretary, who had this wonderful story. Her office was right between Murray Gell-Mann's and Richard Feynman's. The first thing that Helen tells me is, well, you know, Murray's actually, he heard you were coming out here from some of the other scientists you contact, so he called ahead and asked everyone to, you know, he said it was okay if they talked to you, but please not to tell him any funny stories. I said, oh, okay, funny stories. And it turns out now he was thinking he was going to do something like what he called Feynman's joke book. You know, surely you're joking. Joking, Mr. Feynman, and he, you know, about funny, rollicking stories from Murray's life. So I thought, oh, well, great, now everyone's going to be really inhibited. And of course, it was just the opposite. I went into Fred Zachariasen's office, I think, first, and I said, well, I hear Murray's, you know, told everyone not to tell me funny stories. You know, Fred just kind of groans and goes, funny stories? I don't know many funny stories about Murray. He kind of grits his teeth and then goes on to unload all of this. This great stuff. So the more I did this, the more I knew it would filter back to Murray. And meanwhile, I'm living in Santa Fe, so I like run into him in the Albertsons supermarket, you know. And I see him at parties. He's friendly. He invites me to his parties at his house there. And like his wife Marcia's, I guess it was her 60th birthday party with the best mariachi band in New Mexico, of course, by their indoor swimming pool. And so I'm slowly getting a sense of what Murray's life is and just seeing him casually. And I would see him at like Santa Fe Institute dinners. And then I would just ask him some things casually, not taking notes. And he would, you know, Murray loves to talk and tell stories. And he's a real sociable, gregarious person. And he would talk, you know, and I would remember these things and go back and write them down and continue to interview other people. Finally, at some point, I think I had met Murray and his wife, then Marcia, at some event, and we were talking, and again, it was all very friendly. And then later, Marcia spoke to me and said, well, I think it's really kind of silly that Murray, you know, isn't cooperating with his biography. And I, you know, I'm telling him that I think he really should, you know. And you know, I kind of thought it was in his interest too to, you know, get some input into the project. Finally, one day I talked to him and he said, oh, you know, this is really silly. I mean, I'll be happy to talk to you, you know. So then, you know, it broke the ice after about a year, I think it was. And we sat down to it, finally amounted to about probably 12 hours of tape recorded interviews in his office. And so now the book was really, you know, the research was really converging at that point, but I really wanted access to his files. He has like half of his garage filled with these cardboard filing cabinets by every year. You know, this is someone that never threw away a carte blanche receipt. And they're all in there going back to the 50s. And I used to ask him if I could go through his, every time I saw him, I'd ask him if I could have permission to go through his files. And he'd say, well, no. You know, I really need to go through those first and organize them because, you know, I'm just not sure what's in there, and, you know, knew that wasn't going to happen anytime soon. And finally, one day I asked him, I said, well, you know, the way the law is, you know, there was recently this biography that had come out or tried to come out of J.D. Salinger, the American author, and Salinger had managed to block it because it quoted from Salinger's personal papers. And even though these personal papers were actually in a university archive and the author was able to get access to the archive, the courts ruled that you still had to get official permission from the writer of the letters to actually use them. So I mentioned this to Murray and then he said, oh, so you'll have to get permission in order for me to actually quote anything directly. He said, yeah. And he goes, oh, well, in that case, I guess there's no problem. You can go through my archives. And then he left for a few months. He was going to the University of Texas for some reason. And then I looked at his secretary, and she kind of looked at each other, sort of dumbfounded, and said, well, he did say that, didn't he? He said, yeah. So said, well, let's go. So for the next month, every couple times a week, I'd drive over to Murray's house with the secretary, and we'd open up the garage, and I'd go through and get what looked like interesting boxes. We'd put them in my Jeep and haul them back to Murray's office. So I sat there in Murray's chair looking out at the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and just going through this stuff. And it really satisfies any voyeuristic instincts I ever have to go through these. And everything was all together. Again, whether it was a credit card receipt or personal letters, there were just these beautiful letters from Murray's first wife, Marcia, who died tragically early of cancer, and just beautiful letters. And there was a letter from Robert Oppenheimer to Murray's draft board saying that they really should give this guy a deferment because he was going to solve the great problems of physics or something, and this was more important to the war effort than sending him overseas. And there were a few letters between Murray and Richard Feynman. So early on, I learned that in between Murray and Francis Lowe, a lot of letters in which they were doing physics. And he was a pretty good correspondent back then, and like most of us, became less so. So eventually, I got all this wonderful material from that, and then was writing the book. And it wasn't. The way I work is I don't do all this research and then, now you're done, and then you sit down, chapter one. But I'd written chapter one quite a bit earlier, and I would first interview people in that stage of his life and write a draft of the chapter. And, by the time you're done, you'll have ended up redoing it, 100 times, it seems like. But, slowly working my way through the book, and at some point I finally, was getting pretty close to the end. I was interviewing Murray about the Santa Fe Institute days and about his work with the MacArthur Foundation, things like this, and kind of converging on the end point. And at this stage, he asked me, says, "Well, of course, if you're going to let me read all of this before it's published, right?" I said, "Well, I don't know, Murray. It's my book about you. It's your life seen through, as best as I can, through my eyes and my filters, and learning as much as I can and doing my best efforts. And I'm not sure that, it would make me feel rather inhibited if I'm doing anything interpretive or describing things about you that might be less than flattering." And so we went back and forth and back and forth on this. And at some point he suggested something that I almost thought might be good, where he said, "Well, you give it to me and I'll just, correct you on the science." But I had that experience once with running two paragraphs by Murray that I was writing that were going to fit into something else. And as I recall, it was a very grueling experience of hours in the telephone in which we deconstructed every single sentence. And this is someone who understands language on so many levels as well as mathematics. He looks at a sentence and it's just shimmering with connotations, and it's just like this Alice in Wonderland rabbit hole, and you're just down there. And I talked to a lot of his friends, and their basic reaction was, "Oh God, no, don't do that. The book will never come out. It'll be, it'll be just this horrible, horrible swamp that you'll be slogging through." And so finally I decided, no, I'm not going to do that. I can't remember how many, a dozen or so physicists read the manuscript beforehand, including physicists that knew Murray really well, so that's the way I do my fact checking. Plus, I had a lot of friends read it who aren't scientists that just might read the story. So again, this, as I've mentioned before, where you're interpolating between these two shoals of making it clear and accessible, but not getting into too much detail. So finally, the book came out in 1995, and my great hope was, even though I'd never heard Murray say a single positive thing about anything that had ever been written about him, or I had heard him say very few positive things about anything that had been written about anything that he understood something about. So I didn't have really high hopes that he would embrace the book and say, "I was wrong, this is really nice, there's some things I would have done different." And no, that wasn't. It was more like he, went through the roof. with a certain amount of aplomb and humor. I mean, one of my favorite stories was he was back at Caltech on a visit and walking through the Athenaeum, and he saw a professor, there was a professor, I think of history or some other subject that he knew, who had, was reading a copy of Strange Beauty, and then he walked up to Murray and said, "Murray, would you autograph my copy of Strange Beauty?" And Murray said, "Oh, I'd be glad to," and he inscribed it, and he said, "This is a very well-written novel based on my life. Please don't mistake it for a biography." So, meanwhile, I heard from dozens of Murray's friends, colleagues, enemies, family members, and I think the consensus was that, you know, I really nailed him. This is a very, very, very good description. Very good description of what he's like and his place in scientific history. There were some, you know, naturally some physics, little physics mistakes here and there that I slowly corrected during subsequent editions, and it came out and it got rather widely reviewed. I was very pleasantly surprised. I think probably far more than anything I've written, just all over United States and England. It was a finalist for this big British Science Book Award. And it got it reviewed in places like The Economist, where you wouldn't normally. And there's Phil Anderson again in the Times Higher Education Supplement, Financial Times, and as well as in the physics journals, Wilson Quarterly, The New Yorker. This was one of my favorites. Was from David Goodstein down at Caltech. Did I scroll past it? Yeah. Let's see. Oh, there. Yeah, he said, "And altogether, I don't envy Murray the weird experience of reading so penetrating and perceptive a biography of himself." And that was kind of nice, yeah. In the Caltech Alumni magazine. So that's the story. To this day, Murray and I both still live in Santa Fe, and I occasionally see him, but we usually kind of, you know, the last time I saw him was actually at the funeral, sad occasion for a son of a friend, and you know, I kind of walked by and saw him, and Marcia was there and smiled, and we talked, and Murray just kind of looked away like this. So, he wasn't pleased with the outcome, but I hope a lot of people were, and it was a grueling experience, 5 years of my life. And that's all I think I'll say about this. I wanted to end just with a couple, and then I'll ask for, you know, questions, or people can tell some stories that I might use in the next edition. These are two quotes from Murray Gell-Mann that I used as epigraphs to the book, along with a picture of him as a child. And they struck me as being rather apropos to some of the things that been talking about with superstring theory lately, and just the dilemmas. Yeah. Thank you very much. Any questions or observations, or either about Murray or about writing a biography or books or writing about science in this form? Yes. No. No. Not yet.
I'm going to ask you a question. So you said it was 5 years.
Yes.
And you said you were on sabbatical for what?
Oh, yeah. That was actually... Oh, no. The first... I was on the sabbatical, or the equivalent of a sabbatical. It's one where you don't get paid anything. From the New York Times, I took a year leave of absence, and then with the advance I had for a different book that I wrote before this, I spent a year in Santa Fe, and then I came back to New York, and I worked out an arrangement with the Times where I could work for them remotely from Santa Fe part-time on a contract, and then worked on the book. So while I was doing the book, I also, they'd never give you a big enough advance to live for 5 years. I mean, some people get them, but I certainly haven't. But between the advance and writing about anywhere between 8 and 12 stories a year for the Times, I was able to, you know, basically replicate what I would have been making if I'd stayed in New York and on staff at the newspaper. So, yeah, 5 years. That's just basically from start to finish. You know, from when I signed the contract, started the research, wrote the book, and then and then delivered the manuscript. And then it's about another year after you deliver the manuscript of editing and fact checking before it actually comes out. So, yeah. If there's any, you know, any of you have read the book, if there's any stories you know that aren't in there. This is one of the hardest things about writing something like this, is when it's over, you're hearing, I don't know, I mean, maybe someday they'll, you know, I mean, you know, it's Murray, while it ends with Murray still very much living, thank goodness, and still married to Marsh Southwick, which is not the case anymore, so at some point I'm going to have to update it with an epilogue, either the book, or of course now with the internet, I can just do it on the web page for the book if necessary. But I'd like to do a revised edition sometime. Okay, well, good. Thank you.